It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan Gervie and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Kerry Kasem.
A good afternoon, Los Angeles, and all of you listening around the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie, and of course, I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan Gervie and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here, right here in Los Angeles, to be the managing partner of your life. You are listening to Talk Radio 790 KABC. And today, unfortunately, I am flying solo as my partner in crime, Kerry Kasem, has the day off. But we will wish Kerry well, and we will have an amazingly unbelievable great show. So, many of you know that the O.J. trial took place 20 years ago, and believe it or not, on October 3rd, 1995, that verdict was reached. And we all heard the not guilty verdict. And today, as well as next week and the week after, we are saluting 20 years of the most important trial of the century, of last century. We are saluting the O.J. trial with none other than the three attorneys who represented O.J. Two of them, unfortunately, have passed away. But we're having the live ones on today. Alan Dershowitz, the famed civil attorney and civil rights defender, is with us. Next week we have Effley Bailey, and then we will follow up with Robert Shapiro. So I'm so happy right now to welcome the leading defender of civil liberties, Alan Dershowitz. He has been known as the longtime Harvard Law School professor, and now we can actually call him emeritus. Alan Dershowitz, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you. I'm glad you got me. I'm 77 years old, and
That's amazing. You know, I got to tell you,
you got to get me before I'm gone.
No.
You've got
many years, and I got to tell you, you are emeritus. I always dreamed of being an emeritus because that is something you can look back on your career and think everything that you've done for all the students, the Harvard Law School students.
10,000 of them.
10,000, and there's a lot of famous ones. In fact, we may even talk about President Obama because wasn't he a student of yours?
Well, he was a student at the Harvard Law School. He tried twice to get into my legal ethics class, but he didn't make the cut. Sorry.
He didn't make the cut.
It wasn't my fault. It was the computer. But he still complains when he sees me.
And I want to talk a little bit in a minute about the Klaus von Bülow case because you had two famous Harvard Law students who helped you in that case. But before we get to that, there are so many things that are going on in your life. In fact, you were recently retained for another case, the Sands China case. We'll talk about that. It's a wrongful termination case. Mm-hmm. You're talking about all of these issues, the Constitution, and of course you've just come out with a new book on the Iran deal. How do you find the energy, Alan Dershowitz, at 77 years old?
You know, my much younger wife in her 60s always asked me the same question, where do I get the energy from? I don't know. I was just born with a lot of energy, and I can't sit still. I've been trying to retire, but it just doesn't work. I'm busier than ever. I'm not teaching students anymore, but I'm consulting on cases, arguing an occasional appeal. I wrote two books this year, one, the case against the Iran deal, and the other one called Abraham, the world's first but certainly not last Jewish lawyer, kind of a history of lawyers seen through the eyes of the patriarch Abraham from the Bible.
So let's talk about that, Alan. Let's go back in your life because you have said that your father, Harry Dershowitz, was very influential in your life and your opinions thoughts, and he had a strong sense of justice.
He did. My father was functionally the oldest of eight children. He had an older brother, but he was very sickly. So my father was kind of the strong guy, and he was the one who protected his family against bullies. And, you know, I grew up in the post-Holocaust era. I was born in 1938, so, you know, I was 7 years old when we learned about our family being killed in Europe. And my father's message was always defend the underdog, whether the underdog is Jewish or black or Latino or gay or anything. Always defend the underdog. That's the Jewish way. And I have taken him very seriously. And he also taught me always fight back.
Now,
and he also taught me never turn on your friends. I mean, there were a lot of kind of lessons from the street that I learned from my father.
And it makes a lot of sense when we talk about it from a moral perspective. But let's talk about your father's politics. Back in the day, there was the Workman's Circle or Der Arbiter Ring. There was socialist values. There was people like Shalom Aleichem who talked about non-religious ways of making an impact in the world. Your father was more of a religious man. Did he identify with some of these socialist opinions and viewpoints
at
that
time?
Not at
all. No, my father hated communism as much as he hated fascism. He believed in individual enterprise and working hard. He worked 6 days a week, and believe me, if he wasn't Orthodox, he would have worked 7 days a week. There's the great cartoon of the chassid on the phone wearing, you know, his business suit, saying to his client, "I'm available to you 24/6. That was my father, 24/6.
That's funny.
Came Friday night, of course, everything stopped and no business was done. But my father worked very hard. He was very proud that he had a small little shop on the Lower East Side. Never made much of a living, but he did it by the labor of his own hands. So he was not at all a socialist. You know, he was a Franklin Delano Roosevelt Democrat. He liked Mayor LaGuardia, Mayor Wagner. You know, he was a typical kind of liberal who hated segregation. He had black clients and customers. He was a very good man. But he didn't live long enough to really see the fruits of his labor. He saw my success, and that made him very, very proud. But he developed Alzheimer's when he was in his late 60s, and
wow.
So the last 7 years of his life were very unpleasant for his family, probably less than for him.
But he did see your success. At least you were one of the youngest Harvard professors, in fact, the youngest, at 28 years old, and he was around to see and shepnachas from you at that time.
Mm. He was the most surprised person in the world because I barely made it through elementary school. And high school, I had a 68 average when I graduated, and was suspended from the varsity basketball team in my senior year for academic deficiency. I went to a yeshiva, and I just didn't get along with the rabbis, didn't get along with the principal. And the best thing that ever happened to me is I was turned down for admission by Yeshiva University. I may have been the first person ever turned down for admission by yeshiva.
And, Alan, that was coming from Yeshiva High School. Wasn't it an automatic admission?
Automatic, but Rabbi Zuroff, who was the principal of the school, got on the train, went all the way up to Washington Heights, and told Dr. Belkin, the president of Yeshiva University, "Don't admit that kid. He's a bandit.
A
bad kid." And so I made it to Brooklyn College by the skin of my teeth, where I went straight A's. So I never got a B in my life. I went from C's to A's. All I needed was a change of environment. I loved Brooklyn College. I've donated all my papers, over 1 million papers, all of my case records, everything to Brooklyn College. Without Brooklyn College, I'd be selling shoes in Brownsville in Brooklyn. I'd be a good shoe salesman, believe me.
Yeah.
But that's what I'd be doing. I would never have been able to get into college.
Did you also say that there were teachers who told you that a lawyer requires a big mouth and no brain?
That was my principal. He said, you should go to a profession that requires a big mouth but no brains, so you should either be a lawyer or a conservative rabbi. This was my Orthodox principal who couldn't stand conservative rabbis. Who thought
I can imagine.
Stupid.
I don't think conservative rabbis would like to hear that description.
They laugh when I tell them the story. But, it taught me a lot. It taught me how to fight back. It taught me that teachers don't know everything. It taught me to question authority.
Yeah.
And on balance, I would do it over again. But thank God for free public education. You know, the one thing I really think that's terrible about this country that I love
right.
is that it doesn't provide free college education for every person who qualifies to go to college. It's an asset. We are creating an asset. It's like building a bridge. It's like building a road. Give a kid a college education. It doesn't have to be a fancy one. It could be in the city. I went to an urban college. We didn't have much of a great, campus. I walked to college every day. We didn't have fraternity houses. But I learned so much, and it allowed me to turn around my life. And I feel so bad for kids like me today who don't have the money to go to college, who have to borrow and end up owing $250,000 when they get out. I didn't know a penny.
You know,
I got a state scholarship. I was able to even earn money during college, and then I worked, of course, while I was in college.
Alan, that's really hitting home with me because I grew up in Canada, and we just naturally went to our provincial college from high school. I was supposed to go to the University of Manitoba. I would have had like a free ride. It's $1,000 or something to go get your classes, get your education. You could either walk there, take a bus there. And for some reason, I told my parents that I was going to go to Brown University, which cost a lot more, and they couldn't understand it for exactly what you are saying, that you have a great school right down the street. What do you need to go to Providence, Rhode Island, and pay all this money?
Yeah, no, it's understandable. Look, I missed the college experience. I didn't live in a dormitory. I lived at home. I shared a room with my little brother, a tiny little room, and I didn't have any place to study. What I did when I wanted to study for an exam?
What did you
I'd get on the train. And for a nickel, I'd go to Coney Island and back. I'd sit in the little caboose in the front of the train because it was a little private.
Yeah.
And I'd study because I didn't have any place to study in the house. Everybody was screaming and yelling. It was a kind of typical Jewish middle class, lower working class home. And people were visiting all the time. And I really wanted to study. And so that's one of the places I studied.
So,
also, sometimes I'd stay in the library at Brooklyn College and study there.
One of the things you haven't mentioned is your mother, Claire. How did she impact your education?
Well, my mother was just absolutely brilliant. If she had been born 50 years later, she'd have been on the Supreme Court or the president. She was off the charts brilliant. She remembered everything, remembered everybody, could analyze any person, anything that happened. She just was smart as could be. But she had to drop out of. She was the first person in the history of her family to enter college, 1929, City College. She lasted 3 months. Remember what happened in 1929 in the fall, the Depression. And she had to drop out of school to work. And so she worked for $12 a week, and then she got a raise for $13 a week. Never went back to college until in her 80s. She went back to Brooklyn College and took some classes not for credit, which she absolutely loved. And the students mistook her for the professor because she had such profound insights and real street smarts. So I was very lucky genetically.
So other than the intellect of your mother, what did you learn from her? Was she always on you trying to get you to study, or did she leave you alone and think, oh, Alan's just going to do fine on his own?
No, she thought I would not do fine. She didn't think I was studious. In fact, when they administered the first IQ test, I was in elementary school, and I got the top grade in the school on the IQ test. The first, the teacher thought I cheated. Who would cheat on an IQ test?
Yeah.
Second, so they put me in the advanced class. My mother came and complained, says he's never be able to be in the same class with Arthur Adelman and Jerry Blau, the smart kid. So she got me put back in the other class. So she didn't think that I was as smart as at least my later grades seemed to suggest. So she always worried that I was fooling people, maybe. Maybe someday they'd discover I wasn't as smart as they think I am.
Right.
My mother said to me, why did they make you a professor? What, are you that smart? Why did they make you a professor? You can teach other people? These people went to Harvard and Yale and Princeton. You went to Brooklyn College. How can you teach them?
Wow. Well,
so, you know.
She really learned something about you from your illustrious career. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We are talking with the leading defender of civil liberties and prolific author, Alan Dershowitz. We will be right back.
Last time the Republicans squared off in a debate, a record number of Americans tuned in and sounded off. This Wednesday, Donald Trump, Ben Carson, Jeb Bush, and the rest of the GOP hopefuls square off in back-to-back debates. And 790 KABC is there. Broadcasting live from the spin room at the Reagan Library, beginning at noon. Get the real story as it unfolds, an insight you will only hear here. The CNN Republican Presidential Debate, live from the Reagan Library. Coverage gets underway Wednesday at noon, only on Live and Local KABC.
Any person who makes rights or causes to be made any knowingly false or fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn to get you through the nightmare. Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
How would you like to make some serious cash flipping houses? Hi, my name is Nick Vertucci, and over the last 3 years, my elite team of committed house flippers have flipped over 1,500 properties across the country using my three-step fortunes and flipping system. This year, we plan on doubling that by growing our team in your area. All interested can call now, and I'll send you a free copy of my Fortunes and Flipping CD kit that will show you how to get in, get out, and get paid flipping houses. In my free CD kit, I eliminate all the guesswork and break down my quick and easy process for evaluating properties for a quick turn and instant profit. And I'll show you how to access unique financing programs to get your deals done.
Call 800-781-0566 to get your free kit and receive free tickets to a live workshop coming to your area that includes a free meal, a GPS smartphone watch, power charger, and USB drive loaded with powerful information free for all who attend. Call 800-781-0566. That's 800-781-0566.
Talk Radio
77790 KABC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervey's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
And we are back right here on Gervey's Law. I'm Alan Gervey, and this is Talk Radio 790 KABC. And we are so privileged to talk to a living legend, Alan Dershowitz. He is everywhere. I think Newsweek has called him one of America's most distinguished defenders of individual rights. He, of course, was the appellate advisor for the defense in the O.J. Simpson case, and it has now been 20 years since O.J. Simpson case. And I know, Alan, you are being asked quite a bit now about the O.J. Simpson case. When you look back 20 years from now, at that point, how did you feel when that verdict was read?
Well, it's interesting, because we knew the night before that there was a verdict. We didn't know what it was, and they asked me to fly out because we were anticipating the possibility of a guilty verdict, and they wanted the appeal to start immediately, wanted me to make a bail application, all of that. But it was the day before Yom Kippur, and so I did not fly out. I said, look, I want to be with my family on Yom Kippur, the holiest Jewish day. That was my Sandy Koufax moment. I grew
right
up in the same block as Sandy Koufax, so I was inspired. So I watched the verdict on television with all of my student researchers, and we all wrote down our predictions and put them in our hands and closed them, and then the verdict came out, and I would say most of us were wrong in our prediction.
Now, did you know the night before, because we've read that O.J. Simpson was asked for some autographs from some of the prison personnel, which suggested that either they thought he was going to be freed or they knew something?
We didn't know anything. I certainly didn't know anything. I can't imagine that the police knew, but they were probably told to anticipate the possibility that he would go free and to plan for that. So I'm sure that's why they asked for it. I know that I didn't know. I can tell you this. There was a truck outside of my house, and my neighbor, who was an electronic engineer, spoke to the truck guy and found out that he had a parabolic microphone pointed at my window to overhear my conversations, because he thought maybe I would know what the verdict was, and he was representing an independent television report, and he wanted to break the story. But, of course, I didn't know. But that really took a lot of nerve to do that kind of thing.
Now, there's a famous picture when the acquittal was announced with F. Lee Bailey standing beside O.J., and we have on the other side Johnny Cochran, and then you have Robert Shapiro, who seems to be walking out of the picture. Of course, Do you have any regret that you weren't? You explained that you were celebrating or you were observing Yom Kippur at the time. Do you have any regrets that you weren't in that famous picture? And
no.
Secondly, was Robert Shapiro really pissed off about the verdict?
Well, I don't know about Bob's views of the verdict. He said some things that he probably shouldn't have said after the verdict was over. But, no, I'm happy I wasn't in the picture. I don't celebrate victories of my clients. I refuse to celebrate, particularly in cases of crime. A woman is dead. A man is dead. There's nothing to celebrate. You know, there was a trial. The trial came to a result. That's the way our legal system operates. I have never attended a victory celebration. One, I have won many, many cases. I've probably won as many criminal cases as any lawyer in the United States. But I don't go to celebrations. I refuse to. I didn't go to celebrate Klaus von Bülow's victory. There was a woman in a coma. I'm not celebrating. And, you know, you can feel proud of your legal work, but I feel just as proud of my legal work when I lose a case if I've done a good job. And so I'm glad I wasn't there because I would have walked away and not celebrated.
Now, you've said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you assume that all your clients are lying and are guilty, so you're rarely disappointed because you don't really expect much. Is that true?
Let me explain what I said and what I meant. When I take a case initially, of course I always presume my client guilty. You have to do that. It's like if a person walks into the emergency room with a chest pain, you presume that he's having a heart attack. You don't presume it's indigestion. You always treat the worst possible case. If I presume my client innocent, I would let the police search him. I'd let them interrogate him. I always have to act as if my client is guilty and protect him because it's much better to falsely assume guilt than to falsely assume innocent. And often I'm pleasantly surprised, and my clients turn out not to be guilty.
And doesn't that keep your wits about you? I know for my trials, I always make sure that I look at the worst-case scenario, so I'm prepared to present the arguments that are going to be best suited for my client.
Absolutely, and you don't want to be sandbagged by the prosecution that knows more than you do about the case. And remember, the person who knows the most about the case, if he's guilty, is the client. Then the prosecution, because they've been investigating the case probably for months. And usually when you're a defense attorney, you come in at the last minute and you know the least about the case. So it's presumptuous to assume anything except as a working assumption. And clients will come to me often when I first meet them. Mike Tyson, I remember, had that conversation with me, and he said, you believe I'm innocent, right? And I said, Mr. Tyson, I'm sorry, but I have no basis for making any conclusions. I wasn't in the hotel room that night with you. I don't know. All I can do is read the record. And so I'm going to do my best to try to find points in the record that will result in the reversal of the conviction. But I can't tell you now that I think you're innocent or guilty. I'm coming in with an open mind. That's the best I can do.
And, you know, I think that the clients really respect you for that, because if you're rah-rah and if you're saying, oh, yeah, you're innocent, I know everything, first of all, they may not be, and secondly, they may think that, you know, you're just doing this gig because I'm a celebrity and you're not really doing the job of a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, some do, some don't. Some really want rah-rah. Some really want cheerleaders, not lawyers. But I think of myself as the pathologist. I read the x-rays, I read the CAT scan, and I have to be totally honest with the client, tell them exactly what I think. Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, the job of the lawyer is to predict what the courts will do in fact. And that's what I have to do. I have to be scrupulously honest with my clients and tell them what I think is the best analysis and the best argument we can make. But I can't be his cheerleader.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I remember back when I was in college at Brown University, down the street, Klaus von Bülow was being tried in Newport, Rhode Island, and this was very interesting. You were right in the limelight, and there was something that came out of that trial that I forever have thought about when you talk about the reasonable doubt standard. I really didn't understand it until the Klaus von Bülow case. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, reasonable doubt is very counterintuitive. Basically, when I have a jury, the first question I ask them is, if after hearing all the evidence, you come to the firm conclusion that the defendant probably did it, how would you vote? And anybody who says conviction, I strike them. Probably is not enough, even if you come to a firm conclusion. It's counterintuitive. It's the only area in life where we resolve doubts with better 10 guilty go free than one innocent be wrongly confined. And so it's very hard to explain that to a jury, what a reasonable doubt means. And it's very important for a jury to understand that. Now, most juries don't base their cases on reasonable doubt. They just decide, did he do it, didn't he do it? They don't think about it in any kind of a quantitative or even qualitative way. They just come to a conclusion which is more likely guilt or innocence. But you have to persuade them that even if they think he's probably guilty, that's not good enough.
But isn't it a problem when we look at the average juror and they don't have the intellect that you do or the intellect that someone else might have, and you expect from them to understand that concept?
It's very hard. It's very hard. You really have to do it through example, and you can't just do it by abstract logic. And it's one of the great challenges that criminal lawyers have, to try to communicate what reasonable doubt really means.
And you have made an art of it. In that Klaus von Bülow case, you had Elliot Spitzer and Jim Cramer, Harvard Law students, working with you. Both of them obviously went on to bigger political positions. Do you recall the work that they did, and did you see something in those two that would suggest that they were going to be governor of New York or New York Attorney General?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you always think your students are going to go on to do great things, and many of them, in my case, have done great things. On my team in that case was also the former dean or major professor, Susan Estridge, at University of Southern California.
Right, we know her well around
right
here.
Chris Edley worked with me on that case. He was the dean, I think, at Berkeley Law School. So I had pretty powerhouse group. And then I had another guy named Mark Fabiani, who's a great lawyer in California, runs a crisis management firm. He was one of my students. I had a great legal team behind me, and that's important. And, you know, I use the Mission Impossible model. I don't have a law firm. So when I get retained in a case or when it's a pro bono case, the same thing, I put together a Mission Impossible team. I get the best lawyers I can from my classes, from around the country, and I put together a team that I think fits the case. And so far, that model has been very successful.
We are talking to Alan Dershowitz right here on Gervie's Law, and he was part of the dream team for the O.J. trial. But after the Klaus von Bülow trial, you became a writer, in fact, a very good one, with Reversal of Fortune inside the von Bülow case. Were you proud of that book and the movie, the Academy Award movie, after that?
Well, particularly proud of the movie because my son was the producer, and it was his idea. He took the book to Hollywood, and he got Nicholas Kazan to write a brilliant script. You know, I was, of course, very happy with the movie. I was unhappy with some aspects of it. It showed me playing basketball. I had Ron Silver playing basketball, and I'm a much better basketball player than Ron Silver.
I'm surprised you didn't say you're a much better looking guy than Ron Silver.
No, he's a pretty good looking guy. I like him very much, but I could have taught him a thing or two about basketball. And it also had me throwing telephones. I don't have temper tantrums. So when I told my son, he said, "That's not you, Dad. That's the Dersh character on the screen.
Oh, yeah.
Establish his passion." I said, "Can't you think of a better way of establishing passion than by throwing a telephone?"
You know, it's such a great movie, and for those younger folks who haven't seen it, they really should watch it because there's so much you learn about the legal system, again, mm-hmm, about cross-examining witnesses, about paying off witnesses, perhaps, about reasonable doubt. There are so many concepts that bring it all together in that movie. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to Gervie's Law. We're going to be right back after this message. We are talking with Alan Dershowitz, who, of course, is one of the leading defenders of civil liberties, and we're going to talk about some of those civil liberties coming right up. Stay tuned.
At TIAA Cref, our record sounds like a broken record. We got impressive results in 2013. And 2014, same thing. We're like, hey, weren't we just here? Then 2015, boom, more impressive results. That's the kind of record you'd expect from a company that's created to serve and built to perform. Intelligent investing, powerful results. Visit TIAA.org. TIAA Cref Individual and Institutional Services, LLC. Investing involves risk.
Tiny mortal, you've done angered the football gods.
Hey, fool, don't you know what day it is?
What are you doing listening to the radio when you should be watching great college football like Iowa taking on Iowa State at 4 p.m. Eastern on Fox?
Or Stephen F. Austin at TCU at 3:30 p.m. Eastern on FS1.
Here endeth the lesson.
College football on Fox Sports and Fox Sports 1. Honor thy Saturday, every Saturday.
Get news, weather, sports, markets, and traffic first on the Fords.
Wow, it's actually kind of brilliant.
Only here.
J-A-B-C.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervey and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Welcome back to Gervey's Law. That's right. This is Gervey's Law. I'm Alan Gervey, and I am without Carrie Kasem today. She is taking a well-deserved break. She will be back, I hope, next week when we talk to Effley Bailey. But we are talking right now with Alan Dershowitz, and we are learning a lot about the life and times of Alan Dershowitz. I want to talk, Alan, about the Constitution a little bit. You have been such a strong proponent of the Constitution and understanding civil liberties and civil rights. Let's talk a little bit about pornography, because that's always a sexy subject for many people. And you had a case back in the 70s, the Deep Throat case, of the appeal of Harry Reams. Talk about the First Amendment, and where does it end? Do you believe that, in as far as pornography goes, that it's an open slate and there should be no limits on it, or is that something that needs to be curtailed?
Well, I don't like pornography, particularly if it's out in the public, but people have the right to choose to watch what they want to choose. I don't like Nazi literature. I don't like, anti-Semitic literature, racist literature. They're all protected by the Constitution. So for me, it's not about the content of pornography. It's about choice. And when I did both the I Am Curious Yellow and the Deep Throat case, I refused to see the movie. I said, essentially.
You didn't see the movie?
No. I still to this day haven't seen it. I said, basically, look, I haven't seen this movie. You haven't seen this movie. Now the government's trying to make you see this movie. This is about choice. If I want to see the movie, I should have the right to see it. And if you don't want to see the movie, you should have the right not to see it. It's very much about choice. In fact, I analogized it to issues of birth control and abortion, and that got some feminists very angry because they were on the side of choice when it came to birth control and abortion, but they weren't on the side of choice when it came to choosing what one wanted to read. And yet, of course, choosing what one wants to read has a much higher value in the Constitution than choosing birth control or abortion, which aren't mentioned in the Constitution speeches, of course, highlighted in the First Amendment. So I've always seen this as an issue of choice and liberty. And in countries where you can't see things, you also must see things. In China, they make you watch propaganda films. In the Soviet Union, they made you watch propaganda films. In Iran, they make you watch things.
Right.
In America, they don't make us watch anything, and they can't tell us what we should see and what we can't see. So I'm going to continue to defend it. I think child pornography is a little different because the making of child pornography involves a serious, serious crime.
And probably a psychiatric condition as well.
Well, you never know. But I can tell you it involves a serious crime, and we shouldn't be tolerating the abuse of
absolutely.
Children.
So are there contradictions in the Constitution? When you talk about choices, what about the Second Amendment? Let's talk about gun control. Should everyone have the option, the choice, to bear arms?
Well, if I were writing the Bill of Rights, I would not include the Second Amendment. We're the only country that has a Bill of Rights that includes the right to bear arms, but it's in there, and it's written in a very convoluted way. It talks about militia. But the Supreme Court has interpreted it to give a limited choice, yes, to choose whether to own the gun. I've chosen not to own a gun. Many people choose to own guns, but the Constitution also talks about a well-regulated militia, and I think that strongly implies that the government has the right to regulate arms and regulate what kind of guns you should have. Some Second Amendment extremists would give people, you know, the right to own tanks and machine guns.
That's right. And you know, Carrie Kasem, my partner here on the show, is not here, but a few weeks ago she had a debate with Erwin Chemerinsky, and Carrie is a gun owner, a very proud gun owner. Erwin had some other point of views, saying that Carrie's statistics weren't correct, and I sided with Erwin because it seems to me that you can find statistics any way you want.
I agree with you. Look, the basic statistic that nobody can dispute is that we have more guns and more murders than any countries in the world, and that countries that don't have guns, like Japan and England and other westernized countries that are comparable to the United States in many ways, have far, far fewer gun murders, far, far fewer murders. And that's just the statistic that
But let's talk about post hoc, ergo propter hoc, because we have to talk about the cause and effect. And I'm not arguing with you because I'm on your side, but for these gun people who want to argue that because of that statistic, therefore, we don't need gun control.
I don't think you need statistics to demonstrate kind of natural causation. I'll give you another example. People say that pornography causes rape. Well, I can prove to you that in those countries that ban pornography, there's far more rape than in those countries that permit pornography. And now, those are just facts. There may be many causative factors, but at least the burden shifts to the person advocating the censorship of pornography to demonstrate the opposite. I think the same thing is true with guns. It's just counterintuitive to think that guns have no impact on the murder rate when we see how much murder there is in countries, and even within the United States. In states where guns are widely available, there's far more murder than in states where guns are less widely available. Look, you're having a fight with somebody in your family, and you get really, really angry, and you don't have a gun around, the likelihood of being able to kill somebody is far greater. I mean, you can kill somebody with a pot and a pan, but it's a little easier with a gun, and it's a little easier to have an accident with a gun as well.
I happen to think that percentages of people who get angry and have a gun around and use it are far greater than the percentage of people who are abducted or people who are robbed at gunpoint. It seems to me that we all have these proclivities for anger, yet it is almost a bit of a chance that you're going to actually be held up and need a gun. And what someone said, I can't remember, one of our guests, maybe it was Gloria Allred, I can't remember, but they said that you can't predict how you're going to be able to handle a gun under those circumstances when there's stress.
And
just
remember,
because you have one.
In the middle of the night, a burglar comes into your house. It's the middle of his work day, and you're sleeping. The likelihood that you'll be able to protect yourself against him is pretty low. It gives people a feeling of confidence, but the data doesn't bear it out. But talk about guns and weapons. And now we're talking about Iran trying to get the ultimate weapon, you know, a weapon of mass destruction, nuclear armament, in which they've said, their leader has said, if they get it, they will bomb Tel Aviv and kill 3 to 5 million Israelis, and that will be the end of Israel. And then if Israel retaliates and kills even 10 to 20 million Muslims, it will have no effect on Islam because there are 1 billion Muslims. So, you know, the idea that a country like Iran could be allowed to arm itself with nuclear weapons is so preposterous. And yet this deal that I've written about in my book, The Case Against the Iran Deal, really is a green light to Iran to develop nuclear weapons in 10 years or 12 years, and I just think it's a serious mistake, and I lay out all the arguments against it in my book.
All right, I want to talk about that. I was going to talk about that in a few minutes because I wanted to talk about the concept of modernizing the Constitution, but we can come back to that. You've brought up the Iran deal. I want to talk about that. You have said that you have challenged Obama to a Lincoln-Douglas-style debate. I have a question. I'm on your side, unfortunately. You don't have someone here who's going to defend the Obama deal. I agree with you completely, and I'm not just saying that and sucking up to you because you're on the program. It's just that's where I'm at with this issue. But my question is, if you had a debate, what are the chances that you are going to be able to convince someone? Isn't it true that there are so many unknowns about what is going to happen, and it depends on where you side with the current state of Iran? If you don't understand the history of the Middle East conflict, then perhaps you just look at this as a situation where there's going to be peace. I don't buy that, but how do you convince someone like President Obama in a debate?
Well, first of all, I want to have great debates, a series of 4 or 5 debates with people representing the Obama administration, people representing the opposing view. Look, there is a possibility it will produce peace. That's why the cover of my book has the roll of the dice.
Everything is possible. Hey, Mr. Dershowitz, haven't you been in court where one of your opponents have said something and you said, hey, everything is possible, but let's look at probabilities and let's look at realities.
But even probabilities, the analogy I make is to Russian roulette. You know, there's only a 1 in 6 chance you'll blow your head off, but none of us would play Russian roulette.
Correct.
There is more than a 1 in 6 chance that under this deal Iran gets nuclear weapons. And I think we negotiated it very poorly. I wouldn't hire Kerry or Obama to negotiate a one-month lease for me. They are such bad negotiators. They
yet you
the military option off the table.
Yet, Alan, you voted for Obama two times.
I did. And I support his domestic policies. I support his opening up of Cuba. And I'm not calling him names. I just think this is a bad decision, and well-motivated, but a bad decision that will increase the likelihood of war, that will increase the likelihood that Iran will try to develop nuclear weapons, and make us all less safe. So I'm going to continue to oppose the deal, but I'm going to continue now that the deal is going to be passed in a questionable constitutional manner. It's going to be passed. I'm going to still continue to demand that our political leaders make sure that Iran never, under any circumstances, develops nuclear weapons.
Don't you think we may have put the cart before the horse on this one? Don't we need Iran to acknowledge the state of Israel, to acknowledge its existence, to not have this rhetoric and hyperbole coming out of the place? And I don't care whether the leaders have changed or not, but there's a fundamental animosity toward Israel and toward supporters of Israel. How do we do a deal with that before just nipping that in the bud?
Well, first of all, the major animosity is against the United States. Just today, its leaders said they will ultimately destroy the United States, and we're giving them the means to do that. And, of course, Israel is only the small Satan. But, you know, when Benjamin Netanyahu came and spoke to Congress, I was there sitting right near his wife when he spoke, he came up with a very interesting third alternative that, you know, the president always says nobody's proposed an alternative.
Right.
He proposed an alternative. He said before the sunset provisions are allowed to kick in, before the deal is over, Iran should have to renounce its export of terrorism, renounce its efforts to control Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and other countries, and renounce its desire to see Israel destroyed. And if they engage in those three acts, then the sun can be allowed to set on the provision. But it should not be unconditional. It should be conditional.
And that makes a lot of sense. We have to take a quick break. We've got one more segment with Alan Dershowitz. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We will be right back.
Any person who makes a cause to be made any knowingly false or fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn to get you through the nightmare. Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
End of summer got you singing the blues. Well, don't sing the blues. Listen to the blues at the 3rd Annual Lawndale Blues and Jazz Music Festival, Saturday, September 26th at Jane Addams Park. Join Talk Radio 790 KABC for an afternoon of blues and jazz, plus a charity car show. It's the perfect way to enjoy great music in the heart of the South Bay. And it's all free. For more info, go to KABC.com/events.
Talk Radio.
KABC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Oh, yes, and we are back right here at Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC. I'm Alan Gervie, and we are having a heart-to-heart conversation with none other than Alan Dershowitz, one of the most famous attorneys in the country and in the world. We were just talking about the Iran deal, and by the way, his new book is The Case Against the Iran Deal, How Can We Stop Iran from Getting Nukes? Go on Amazon, get the book right now. It is really interesting. A lot of people don't know a whole lot about the deal. They hear the politics, they hear the media talk, but they don't know the deal, so you need to get that book. You'll have a better understanding. Alan, I want to tell you, I look on my Facebook page all the time, and I see my Jewish friends who are criticizing the president on his policies regarding Israel and the Jews. However, President Obama spoke at the Jewish congregation in Washington, D.C., and I think you actually blogged and said his talk was excellent.
It was. Yeah, no, he made a good argument. He made a good point. Look, he's not an anti-Semite. He's not anti-Israel. He's just mistaken about this deal. And, you know, you don't have to take extreme views and attack him personally. He just negotiated a bad deal and put us in a position where we have to choose between a bad deal or perhaps a worse alternative of rejecting the deal.
Yeah. So if that's the case, are there people out there who are helping him along in his what some people say intransigence, and even Jewish people? We have J Street, and you've been critical of J Street, but are they supporters or are they against Israel, even though they say pro-Israel, pro-peace movement?
I don't think J Street can be called pro-Israel. Virtually every political figure in Israel is opposed to this deal. The 95% of Israeli Jews are opposed to this deal. And J Street supports the deal, and yet they claim to be a pro-Israel lobby. J Street supported the Goldstone Report. J Street opposed Israel's self-defense measures in Gaza. J Street is funded by George Soros, who is an overt anti-Israel radical. One of its leaders publicly stated that maybe it would have been better if Israel had never come into existence. J Street will never allow me to speak to its members because it allows hard leftist supporters of boycott movement, radical supporters of terrorism to speak at J Street, but it will never allow a centrist liberal like me to speak there.
Isn't it true, though, Alan, that Larry Gelman of J Street did invite you to come speak after he had some choice words for you?
No. Read the article. He invited me to come to be a guest, and he's not in a position to invite me. He's not the head of it. I want to get an invitation from Ben-Ami, Jeremy Ben-Ami. That was a phony invitation. Anybody can come and listen. Read the thing carefully. He says, come and listen to us. No, I want to be invited to speak. They want a wide tent. They want to be included in everything that's done by the wider Jewish community. Let them open their tent to people like me, to people like Elie Wiesel, to people like Erwin Kotler, to moderate liberal people who don't necessarily support their agenda on Israel's security.
So where do we go from here with the Iran deal, with America's relationship with Israel, and with Obama's relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Well, first of all, the relationship between Israel and the United States will always be strong. The American people support Israel. The American Congress supports Israel. And most American presidents have supported Israel. I think the relationship has reached a relatively low point over the Iran deal. But I'm proud of both AIPAC and the Israeli government for standing up for what it believes is the right thing. As an American citizen, I'm entitled to petition my government for a redress of grievances. And I have a grievance about this deal. And I'm not going to be shut up about it. I'm going to continue to assert my strong feelings. And if anybody wants to accuse me of dual loyalty, I'm going to fight back. I'm loyal to the United States. I was loyal to the United States when I opposed the Iraq War. President Obama was loyal to the United States when he opposed the Iraq War. Nobody accused him of dual loyalty.
Right.
And nobody should ever accuse me or anybody else who opposes this deal of dual loyalty.
Why do people not understand that you can be in favor of one issue and against another, and it may not be consistent with a political line of thinking, but it may be just based on the actual issue?
One would think that in the United States of America, which has a completely free and open press, that there would be an understanding that we're not bound by party lines, that I wish more Democrats were not bound by party lines. Several of the Democratic senators and congressmen that are voting in support of this bill don't like the bill, and they're voting on it for several reasons. Some of them think that it would be worse to vote down a bad bill than to accept it. Some of them just want to be loyal to their president. Some of them maybe want to be loyal to their party. That shouldn't be the basis. This should have been a nonpartisan vote. There are several Democrats who are going to vote against the bill, but many will vote for the bill.
Is this really the most important foreign policy decision of the century?
I think so. I think if Iran develops nuclear weapons in 10 years, it will be an absolute disaster. It will completely change the nature of the Middle East and have an enormous impact on the rest of the world. It's a disaster waiting to happen, and we still don't know the answer to the question. Does this deal allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons after 10 years? I don't know the answer to that question, and we are entitled to know the answer to that question. The president has spoken out of both sides of his mouth on that question.
Now, wouldn't it be considered for you a very American position to be taking on this? Of course, you have the defender of civil liberties, the democratic perspective behind you, but when you talk about being Jewish, you're not the most Jewish person as far as religiosity goes.
Yeah, ask my mother. She'll tell you.
She'll tell you, I'm sure. And isn't it true your son married a non-Jew and you have a half-Jewish grandson?
I have two wonderful grandchildren who have an Irish Catholic mother and a secular Jewish father, and they're just wonderful kids.
So what do you have to do, Alan, to show that you are just looking at the facts and you're basing all your opinions on America and the relationship that it has with others around the world versus being staunchly Jewish?
But it wouldn't make any difference. If I were a Jew with a beard and sideburns and a yarmulke, I would still have the right to express my views as an American. And nobody should be accused of dual loyalty. Catholics shouldn't be accused of dual loyalty for their allegiance to the Vatican. African Americans shouldn't be accused of dual loyalty for their support of developing countries in Africa.
Yeah.
Greek Americans shouldn't be accused of dual loyalty. We all have multiple loyalties. Women shouldn't be accused of dual loyalty because of their commitment to their gender. Gays shouldn't be accused of dual loyalty because of their commitment to their sexual orientation. We all have multiple loyalties, religious, political, ethnic, racial. But only Jews are singled out for the accusation of dual loyalty, and that's just a serious mistake.
Alan Dershowitz has just hit on every issue I wanted to speak to him about in the next hour. We only have 1 minute, so I really appreciate you going through that list, the laundry list of civil liberties, and why it's important that we respect the First Amendment. Alan, where do you go from here? We only have a minute. What is your future? Because I would love to speak to you next year and
anytime.
Hear about all of these things that you're doing.
Well, I'm going to be litigating cases. I'm going to be writing books. I'm going to be lecturing. I'm going to be traveling around the world, hopefully, if I'm given the good health and continued energy to do it.
Well, as they say, until 120.
Well, Alan, no, what they really say is until 120 in a couple of months, you shouldn't, God forbid, die on your birthday.
That's right,
right,
a couple months.
Good.
There you go. We have been so pleased to have you here at Gervie's Law and Dershowitz. Thanks for all the insight. Best of luck with the new book with the litigation and even some retirement.
I'm going to try to do that. By the way, the book's available on Kindle or in bookstores. The case against the Iran deal, How Can We Now Stop Iran from Developing Nuclear Weapons.
Alan Dershowitz, thanks for being on Gervie's Law.
Thank you. My pleasure. Bye.
And we will see you next week. We've had a great program. Next week, it's Effie Bailey. Don't miss it right here on Gervie's Law, Talk Radio 790 KBC.
The preceding program was a paid commercial announcement. The sponsor is responsible for its content, which Talk Radio 790 KBC does not necessarily endorse or support.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in physics, I learned that I'm a loser.
Today in school, I learned that I'm ugly and useless. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. In history, I learned that I'm trash.
Today in school, I learned that I have no friends.
In biology,
in English, I learned that I make people sick. And at lunch, I learned that I sit on my own because I smell. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes
me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. And in math, I learned that I'm trash.
The only thing I didn't learn in school today...
The
only thing I didn't learn is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
You are round MVP.
Yeah, man. Yo, Drew, I finally got round MVP. Round MVP.
No way. That was some ownage. It's a good thing you got me as your wingman.
Right. You mean when you threw that flash grenade at me?
Whatever, man. Huge round. Seriously, great stuff.
Finally earning round MVP takes determination. So will getting into college. I've got what it takes.
All right, class. I'm going to pass back your test. And the high score goes to Brian.
Oh, yeah. High score, baby.
Visit knowhowtogo.org to learn what you should be doing right now to prepare for college. Start taking the steps at knowhowtogo.org.
I've got what it takes. So do you.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation, and the Ad Council.